And good evening. Good afternoon. And welcome. I know I've already blown it right out of the gate. And welcome to the Comics Experience Graphic Novel of the Month Club. This is our November 2022 edition, and we've got a really good book to you for you today. Well, I'll talk about that in a minute, though. I want to do a little sort of introduction for those of you who don't know. And so a couple things. So first off, we usually do this in the store. We videotape it there and do that there. And so this is the first time we've been on a big stage like this. So I'm a little anxious and nervous and the lights, and it's a little weird, right? We pick a book every single month. And every single month, there's an author signed book plate. That's unique to the book and unique to the store, and is a great collectible. And there's an interview, a live stream interview that we do. When we can make it work, we do it in the store, and when not, we just do it over kind of YouTube or whatever. But we've got 8 years worth of this. We've been doing this for 8 years. I'm Brian Hibbs. I own Comics Experience here in San Francisco. We opened up in 1989. We've been there for more than 33 years now. Which is kind of insane when you say it out loud. We're the oldest comic shop in San Francisco with the same owner in the same location. I think that's kind of cool. The way obviously we sell comics and we sell books, but one of the things that's really key to us being able to succeed in the current San Francisco market and the existence is our graphic novel clubs, where we have members, and we actually have members all over the entire nation. And we've got two clubs. We've got one for adults and one for kids, and this is the adult one. So that was a really, really, really long introduction, very not exciting. Let's get to the actual show itself. The book that we've got this month is a fantastic book. It's smart and it's funny, and everybody, member of the staff, just loved this. It's the Forest Hill Bootleg Society, and it is by Dave Baker and Nicole Goo.
Hello, hey, hey.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, how you guys doing?
Good, good. Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you for having us. Thank you for picking the book.
Yeah, well, it's a good book, you know. And as I said, the staff loved it. The staff voted on it. We all thought that this was just a great piece of comicking.
Thank you.
Which is always the key thing. Which leads me to my first question. My first question is the same in every interview I do. Because I love this question, and maybe you prepared for it. and that's why comics? Of all the things you could be doing, you both really clearly have a lot of craft and style. You could be doing anything. And what is it about comics that speaks to you, that sets you on fire, that makes that the thing that you want to express yourself?
Well, for me, I would say that, A, our book couldn't be told in any other medium, and that's something that we both aspire to, is to create works that are endemically comics. And I think that there's a real beauty and a real mystery to that, which working in an art form that might be culturally underappreciated or have things yet to mine. You know, comics as a medium has technically existed since the beginning of time. It's words and pictures. But in terms of the North American version, basically 100 years, and while movies have existed for 100 years, they haven't been censored for the majority of that time.
Sure.
So there's so much to do in comics, and there's so many vistas that are yet unexplored. It's very exciting to me, and also I kind of feel how, you know, the quote that Bill Sienkiewicz always says, I didn't choose comics, comics chose me.
Right.
And I feel that in my bones. You know, when I was a little kid, I found Tintin at the local library, and as a, you know, a little kid in Tucson, Arizona, I was like, this is a whole other world. There's globetrotting, and he fights aliens, and he's solving mysteries, and also this is kind of weird that Native Americans and gangsters are at the same time. I feel like this guy maybe doesn't know that much about America, but whatever, like, this is amazing. And ever since then, I've been hooked. I love comics. It's in my bones, and it's all I really want to do.
Nice.
Nicole.
No pressure, right? You know, for me, it's if you want to be a storyteller and you like drawing, comics is the most direct way to tell the stories that you want to tell and have the most influence on the stories that you want to tell. Because every other medium, you know, if you're in animation or you're in filmmaking, you're not going to have the same amount of control and influence and on the story that you want to tell, because it is the most direct brain to page that you can get, I think. And the combination with that, with the most direct creator to reader relationship that I've experienced, you know, I've worked in toys, I've worked in a little bit of animation, I've worked in ads and editorial, and there's so much disconnect between you and the person that you're trying to speak to in those realms. This may not be the case for every cartoonist, but Dave and I do a lot of conventions. We hand sell our books. We talk to the people who are reading them. And I'm able to make a thing. We were self-publishing at first, print it ourselves, hand it to someone, and have them take it home, take it to their house, read it, and hopefully enjoy it. And you get to speak to that person and see that it's become a part of their life. And it is for me, a very one-to-one direct impact of you putting yourself and your stories on a page and getting to see the people who enjoy them.
Right.
And for me, that is really what changed. We did our first zine fest in 2015, I think it was, and we made some Xeroxed mini comics, and we had made some stuff before, and I'd been making art since I was a kid, but you know, getting to hand that Xerox zine to someone and have them be excited about it, it changed everything. And I really got stuck.
Yeah. There's also a real relationship between the reader and the text that there isn't in the same way in other media, you know, because the reader controls time in comics. Even though you as the author are trying to control time, the reader actually controls what happens on the page and when it happens, and sequence as well. You know, I find when I read comics, all the time I'm skipping back 3, 4, 5 pages to see, oh yeah, that, wait, oh, now I understand what they were trying to do with that, or, oh, that adds something to the, you know, I never do that with prose, and you certainly can't do it with television and movies.
Yeah.
Do you find this as well?
We made an entire book really about that. We made a book in, I want to say also 2016, maybe 2015, called Suicide Forest, where the entire book is told in double page spreads. It's the same background for the whole double page spread, and the characters move around on the page, and it's a horror book. It's a home invasion story, and that was our attempt to play with the reader's control over the page turn and make them sit with each page and see what's different, spend time with it. And then, you know, we always talk about with horror stories, you know, if you can see the next panel from the corner of your eye, it's not going to be that scary. And so the only way you can have a jump scare in something like that is to have the page turn. So we were taking this idea of the reader's control of their experience and trying to use that to our advantage.
Yeah, I feel like one of the things that's unique about comics is that you're, as a creator, you're not worried about, you're worried about multiple things at once. You're thinking about the composition of an individual page, you're thinking about the composition of panels and how those panels interrelate to each other, and then you're thinking about a double page spread and how the page turn interacts with the next page.
Yeah.
So you're thinking it like it's, you're like Spock thinking of four-dimensional chess all at once.
Yeah.
And I think that's something when you find people in comics that are interested in that problem and compelled by that problem, the comics feel so much different than when it's, you know, a frustrated screenwriter trying to get their movie turned into a thing.
Sure.
Because movies are strictly sequential. They only happen in a sequence of images leading forward in time. And, you know, there's the adage that editing film is sculpting in time, but it's locked where we're making something that's weirdly like raindrops of time that are all happening at the same time, and the viewer is the person that's combining them all mentally and looking at the flow and choosing different ways of reading it. You know, like there's a lot of people, especially I think when you first start reading comics, you just read the word balloons. And then maybe as you kind of mature and move in your comics reading journey, maybe you're looking at the art first, or maybe you're looking at the whole page first, or maybe you're, you know, there's different, everybody reads it differently, which is what's so fascinating to me.
When I first started making comics, I did my thumbnails as single pages, my sketches, you know, and as I progressed through my learning journey of making comics, I started planning everything in double page spreads. Because when you open a page, you're never just looking at one of those pages. Yeah. Even if it's just for a split second, you're looking at the whole page. And you can really use that to your advantage. You can silo your pages, make them, you know, obviously you read this first, obviously you read that second. But even if you're doing that, you're still getting an impact of the whole page at once. And so you really have to be thinking, like Dave said, in double page spread and single page and panels and compositions within the panels and flow of the balloons and everything working together.
Yeah.
And so there's just so many levels of it. And if you're not thinking about the reader's experience of all of that, you're doing yourself a little bit of a disservice, I think, in terms of making a really quality book.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because there's so many different ways you can do comics, and there are absolutely creators who don't even think about that at all and still make fantastic comics.
Totally.
Right?
Absolutely.
100%.
Which is kind of the magic of the
yes.
form, right?
Yes.
Like
yes.
It can be whatever you want it to be. There's no rules.
Yeah.
We make new rules all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, think about the three panel strip. Like, nobody's, it is a pure form of comics, right? And you get exactly what you need in those three panels, but it is a very different thing than what we make, which is, mm-hmm. you know, full length graphic novels and working on the full page like that yeah. as a whole, as yeah. opposed to these, they're kind of like short stories in a way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk maybe about how you got to there in the first place. Did you study art in school?
Yeah, I mean, I've been making art and taking classes since I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. And I studied illustration in college, mm-hmm. Planning to be whatever anyone would hire me for, but mostly looking towards editorial,
yeah.
which I still am interested in. But I was kind of in a... I wouldn't want to say lost place, but I wasn't sure what direction to take after college. Like I said, I was working at a toy company. I had done some graphic design stuff, which was not at all what I wanted. and then I met Dave, and he was like, "You want to make some comics?" And I was like, "No, thank you. That sounds like a lot of work." Because, you know, I had been really into, you know, Sunday strips when I was a kid, and then manga in middle school and high school, okay. and then I just hadn't really read comics or seen them as a potential career in, you know, 5-10 years, something like that. You know, when I was a kid, I was like, I'm going to go to Japan and be a mangaka, and then I realized I had no idea what I was doing for any of that, and I just kind of shifted gears, and, you know, but Dave can be very convincing when he wants to be. And so we started with an 8-page comic for his webcomic that he'd been making and kind of went from there.
Yeah, I was making a webcomic where when I first moved to L.A., I wanted to write more, like just period. I wanted to write webcomics. I wanted to write comics. I wanted to, you know, I had a job writing commercials. That's what got me to L.A. And I was like, I feel like in the comic space, people only think of me as an illustrator because I had published and self-published a bunch of stuff previously.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I feel like if I'm going to really make this pivot into being a writer or viewed as a writer, I need to start with something that's accomplishable with artists who are my friends. So I kind of reverse engineered a project from that where I made a webcomic called Action Hospital where every 8-page story that was in the world mm-hmm. would be paired with an artist. I could get 8 pages out of somebody. That's
sure.
not undoable on the amateur kind yeah. of webcomic scale. And that way, everybody can kind of dip their feet in. If they like it, they can do more. If they yeah. don't, I don't have to worry about getting 40, 50, 100-page graphic novel out of somebody.
And these were gigs that people were doing for free?
Yeah, pretty much.
You were all doing it for exposure?
We were all doing it just to try and do it.
Yeah.
And so I initially was like, I'm not going to draw any of these. Mm-hmm. That went out the window real quick. So, you know, I did, you know, maybe 4 or 5 of them. I had a solid crew of people that I had found both through... the art school that Nicole went to, just because I randomly ended up meeting a bunch of people there. And I went to local drink and draws, and I went to life drawing sessions, and I would just meet people and be like, hey, you're an artist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a writer. You want to try and do
mm-hmm.
a thing?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how Nicole and I met. And I was like, hey, you're really good, like yeah. way better than all of us.
Right.
Like, you want to slum it with us for a minute?
Right.
And she was like, she said, well, I don't know. And I was like, no, it'll be fun. Come on, it'll be fun. And so we did it this little side project, and it kind of kept ballooning, and I started throwing parties where I would buy pizzas invite 10, 15, 20 cartoonists over to my house. Everybody would draw, free draw.
Right.
And then I would bring out the webcomics pages and be like, hey, so your character actually shows up in this panel.
Uh-huh.
Will you just draw them here? And so, like, the high concept of the book quickly became whenever a character shows up, they're always drawn by their artist,
right.
Almost kind of like an actor in a TV show.
Right.
And it worked really well. You know, we started getting a little bit of following online. You know, I would go to conventions. And then that project kind of ran its course. And Nicole and I were like, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to kind of disband the band?
Yeah.
Or are we going to, like, make a super group of the two of us? Because we were kind of the two who took it most seriously. And, like, let's make some mini comics and go to conventions and see what happens.
Yeah.
And very quickly, it became apparent that Nicole is the artist and I'm the writer, and people love Nicole, and we're going to sell comics.
Did you go to school for drawing?
I did. Yeah,
did.
I went to art school, uh-huh. And I for a long time have been trying to. I feel like I've now climbed the mountain of writing comics.
Right.
I also worked on the Star Trek comics and some other kind of, you know, more. You are now anointed, not just a self-publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm doing the art thing again, very seriously, where I have a book that I illustrated that's going to be put out by Top Shelf, and I'm serializing and self-publishing a book right now that'll probably either end up at Top Shelf or Dark Horse. And so I think both of us are cartoonists,
uh-huh.
But our roles when we work together is I'm the writer and she's the
artist.
Yeah,
no, sure. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense. Did you... when did you know that you wanted to make comics? Has that been...
The whole time.
Since
it was very, like, one of my first memories is being 3.5 years old, my sister is being born in the hospital, and my aunt is babysitting me and reading Tintin to me to keep me behaved while everybody's at the hospital.
Yeah.
And she's losing her voice because she's doing a Captain Haddock, like, blue blistering barnacles. And, like, I distinctly remember when that book was finished being like, oh, well, I could just make more of these.
Right.
Like, we don't need to wait to go to the library to get more. I'll make more. Ironically, though, the first comic I ever made was an X-Men comic, so I don't know what that says about me.
When you also have that, I think it was a story when you were 12 and you went to your first San Diego Comic-Con, being like, oh, people, humans make these?
100%.
I think there's a disconnect with a lot of media, but especially comics, where as a kid you're like, oh, they just appear out of the ether.
Yeah.
They just happen. And then when you have that realization that, like, oh, people make these, I could make these, there's a kind of epiphany moment.
Yes.
For a lot of people.
Yeah.
My mom constantly tells a story, like, you know, whenever something good happens for us and, like, a book gets published by Simon Schuster or whatever, she's always like, I remember when we went to San Diego when you were 12 and we could just buy a ticket and just walk in the door. And I remember being like, oh, these are your people. And she was right, like, 100%. Like, I walked into that room and I was just like, oh my God, like, you know, Arizona's not exactly the cultural hub of the world.
Sure.
And so I didn't know anybody who was really into comics. It was
yeah.
just like the thing I was obsessed with that all of my friends were kind of like, yeah, all right, whatever.
Yeah.
And going into that room and, like, just seeing stacks of comics, because I'd never been in a comic book store.
Yeah.
I don't know how my mom learned that there was a San Diego Comic Con. Maybe
and
Wizard
and she
Magazine.
Took you from Arizona
yes.
to San Diego.
Yeah,
that's not a small trip.
No, it was not. And we all crammed in this really weird little hotel room. And yeah, we went. And I was so overwhelmed when we first walked in. I, like, couldn't do anything. And my sister was like, look, did people draw in comics? Look, it's like what you do. And I, like, was speechless. I was just like, yeah, you're right. Whoa. Like, I was, like, high off of, like, the fumes of Jack Kirby or whatever, you know?
Smell of ink.
Yeah. That speedball after Burner.
Did you make comics when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. I had a bunch of stuff. For some reason, I started, like, making... I never published them, but I filled up sketch journals of them,
okay.
like, sequential pages in order with, like, the company logo and, like... I was really into this concept that plumbing pipes would turn into snakes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a comic called Steel Snakes, and I made a bunch of weird comics about, like, snakes coming out. I was really into Keanu Reeves as a little kid, too.
Uh-huh.
And so I had a character called, like, The Outsider or The Stranger, and it was Keanu Reeves in, like, a slouch hat dressed like the Shadow fighting steel pipe snakes.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome.
It was in hindsight, I was like, I don't know why I was really into Keanu, but I loved that guy. Yeah, no, way before anybody else loved Keanu, I was on that train.
You know, Keanu's really into comics. Maybe you could, like, talk to him and come up with a, you know.
Yeah, Keanu, I got
Berserker 2?
Yeah, Berserker 2, colon, Steel Snakes. Yeah, I got it. Let's do it. Let's do it, Keanu. I'm here, man.
That has to be you exercising some fear of snakes coming out of the toilet. Like,
oh, 100%.
It's got to be.
It's got to be, right? Yeah.
Oh, that's funny as hell.
Yeah. But I've been, like, seriously self-publishing since I was probably about 17, 16.
Okay.
I worked in a comic book store. I worked in two different shops in Arizona, but one of them specifically had a really cool clique of kind of, at the time, older than me dudes. They're probably about my age now. Yeah. Who, like, they ran a comics club where everybody would kind of get together on Thursdays and draw comics, and you know, they kind of helped me learn what InDesign was, and like one of them worked at a local print shop, so we printed all of our books from there, and that's kind of how I started figuring out how to have the self-discipline to self-publish.
And you wanted to be a mangaka when you were a little kid, and then thought it wasn't realistic.
I think I just, the combination of the leaps and bounds it would have taken for me to go to Japan, learn Japanese, do all that. And also, I'm a little less of a go-getter than Dave, and trying to figure out how to do any of that and do all the research, it just wasn't going to happen for me. But the combination of that and just a shift in interest. I went from being really into manga and anime and wanting to do that to getting back into like old school Disney animation and wanting to be an animator for years, and then realizing how much you have to draw when you're an animator. And then by the time I got to pre-college, I wanted to be a life painter, because I started taking life drawing classes when I was 14 at the college, and I just fell in love with it. And so I decided to go to college for drawing and painting, and then a couple years into that, I was like, okay, there's not enough direction here. For me to really, I didn't know how I could make it work, make a living at it. And so I switched then to illustration, which actually suited my skills a lot better anyway. And it felt a little bit more commercial. It felt more accessible to what I liked to make, because it was, you know, somewhere in between my tween years of just tracing and copying manga images and what the drawing and painting stuff that I loved later. And so I felt this really, there's a sense of design in modern editorial illustration that is really strong and I really enjoy. And so I kind of shifted there, and then I just graduated, and nobody helps you when you graduate art school.
Right.
And you're just kind of stuck, and I sent hundreds of emails to art directors and postcards, and got, you know, I got a couple responses, but it's a lot of work. Being a freelancer is very, very hard, and so is being a cartoonist. But the thing that I really enjoy about it is that once you've started a book, then you just make that book until it's done.
Right.
And you don't have to be constantly next job, next job, next jobbing, which is, you know, it's just not a skill that I really have.
Yeah.
And I like having the direction of, okay, so I've written a thing, or we've written a thing, and I have a goal for the next year and a half. And so I don't have to constantly be creating new ideas for exhibits or trying to reach out to art directors every 3 months. And I like having that direction. It helps me a lot to be able to consistently make and create things without floundering and figuring out all the time.
Yeah.
I get to explore within the thing that I'm making for a year and a half, and then I get to do a new thing.
I feel like performance is also really integral into what we make and how we make it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when we go to conventions, like, we have a shtick and like bits that we do at the table, and we're very outgoing and gregarious and like hand people books. But also the process that we make comics by is very performative, in that, like, when we're, you know, like, our process usually is we go to a park, I've got an idea or she's got an idea, and then we play catch. We throw a baseball back and forth, and we say, okay, so I want to do a comic about Keanu Reeves fighting steel pipes or whatever. And
right.
I throw it at her, and she goes, steel pipes? Come on. That's not a good idea. And she throws it back. And I go, you know what? You're right. Maybe it's not steel pipes. Maybe it's Keanu Reeves fighting air ducts, and then I throw that back. And we massage these ideas. Don't worry, this Keanu Reeves idea is never going to happen.
Yeah, I don't want to draw that book.
Yeah, she says that a lot too. She says that. That's the, you know that we've reached the terminus of one of my ideas when she goes, I don't want to draw that. And I'm like, okay, all right, moving on to the next idea.
Dave has a very broad range of interests and things that he wants to write about, and mine is a little narrower. And so there are Nicole ideas and there are not Nicole ideas.
Absolutely.
And so sometimes there's a thing that I think is not a Nicole idea, but then we talk about it and he poses it in a way that makes it about sad girls, and then I'm like, all right, okay, I can get on board with this.
Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh. Like the kind of, that's the initial germ of an idea, we massage things, then I kind of go away and write something. We come back together, and then we perform it to each other.
Okay.
So I'll read the scene direction, and she'll read the characters. And you really quickly figure out, A, what she wants to draw, and B, what works, because A, she's kind of reading it in my vocal intonations,
right.
And B, she's reading it with a mindset of like, man, you put like 19 word balloons in this panel. Right. What is going on
right.
here? And you're like, you know what? You're right. That was an accident. That was supposed to be three panels, but I messed it up and blah, 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 blah. We'll change that. And so both of those performance cycles, I feel like are really, they come through in the end work. Mm-hmm. Like I can tell when I read a comic and the person isn't having fun, they're not really like typing with a smile on their face.
Sure.
They're typing because they have to meet a deadline.
Yeah.
And a lot of great comics have been made that way. But I feel like there's something different. There's a different type of magic when you can feel two people coming together and really making something out of pure kind of passion.
Yeah.
The book that we're working on now is, it went through, I think, four different drafts because we would sit down and read it and it just wouldn't work over and over again. And so I would say, you know, this scene needs to be earlier, or we need to add something here, or I don't know what about this doesn't work, but it just doesn't work.
Yeah, and she was right every time. And I knew she was right, but there's always this little safety buffer in the back of my head that's like, man, this scene isn't very good, but maybe Nicole will fix it when she draws it. You know what I mean?
That happens.
No, no, I mean, I do know what you mean. She's a great storyteller.
She's a great storyteller.
Yeah.
And our comics are so collaborative that sometimes just the way she draws someone's face or some small inset panel or the angle at which she starts the establishing shot in the scene out just instantly makes all of my mistakes way less visible.
Sure.
You know? And ultimately the key for our next book was we just had to remove one of the central characters because we'd been pitching the book for like 2 years. We had all these ideas and we had what I think is probably the most crystallized version of like, oh, we know exactly what we're making. Mm-hmm. And then we got down to sit down and make it. And there's a difference between telling somebody, oh, this is what it's going to be, and then actually putting the panels together, 1, 2, and 3, and being like, oh, actually, all of our ideas, they kind of work, but some of the aspects of it that we're most passionate about, or maybe just were a previous iteration that's kind of been moved over to this version or whatever, it just doesn't connect in the right way. So we just had to remove a character.
I think there's a real struggle with comics because they take so long and they take up so much space on the page. To really get full character arcs, full development, your full story in a way that is not hard in prose because you just write it and then it's there, that you really have to be careful with your time and your space on the page. And it really came down to we had too many characters, nobody had enough time, or at least a few of the lower rung characters just didn't quite have enough. And there came a point where I was like, you know, I hate to do this. We both love this character, but I think we need to kill Richie.
And then we did. Mm-hmm. Long live Richie, because he's
and it
dead.
Made the book so much better.
Yeah, it really did.
Yeah,
it's interesting that you're making these decisions between yourself. I mean, because you said it was a pitch,
yeah,
which implies that it was accepted by someone, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. implies you have an editor.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
But you're doing sort of the pre-editing, I guess.
Yeah, I think. We've had really great relationships with editors, and sometimes editors have suggested those changes. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the like process with a capital P happens between the two of us. Mm-hmm. And that's not because editors aren't valuable. They are. But just the way that we make stuff ends up being, you know, like we'll be over at her house watching Star Trek, and in the middle of an episode, I'll pause it and be like, okay, so in the third act, there's a buffalo. And, you know, like, those are the kind of things, it's just, it's the process.
Well, yeah. And I think that comes from being self-publishers for so long. We didn't have an editor for years,
right.
5 years, something like that. And so we're used to doing it on our own.
Yeah.
And I think there's a little bit of defensiveness also, and a little bit of fear of the editor changing what we make, because we didn't have to deal with that for so long. And absolutely, editors can make your work better, 100%. Mm-hmm. But I think we're just a little bit trepidatious of someone saying, this thing that you care about shouldn't be that way, make it different.
Yeah.
And we've really lucked out that we have very accepting editors who trust us, and they kind of just move things around or push it or suggest things and let us have a lot of freedom. But we want to have the thing as close to perfect as we can before we give it to the editor, so they don't have to do that.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. Julia McCarthy, the editor who bought Forest Hills for Simon & Schuster, when in our first meeting, we had pitched the book a couple other places. It had kind of been like received as, oh, this could be interesting, but I don't know. And frankly, the editors that we had been previously talking to were just a little bit older, and Julia is almost exactly our age. And the first question she asked me was, one, were you raised religious? And two, did you buy bootleg anime stuff in high school? And I said yes to both. And she goes, me too. I literally ran a bootleg anime DVD distribution thing in my high school.
Yeah.
And I knew from that moment, like, oh, this person gets what the book is. They're going to have a valuable insight into it because they also come from a nerdy background like the two of us. And they're going to have the best interest of the heart of the project at heart, because they're actively involved in the subculture, as opposed to like, is this an accurate representation of 2005? I was an adult at that point.
Sure.
As opposed to us, where it was a long discussion of, are we going to have T9 in the book?
Right.
And we ultimately ended up deciding not to. But that's something I go back and forth on every day. I'm like, I don't know, we might have messed up not putting that T9 in there. Tick, 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 tick. You know, that texting mechanism is just so representative of that time period.
Sure.
It's also a little different when you're working with comics publishers versus this is our first book at a big book publisher. Right. And with a company the size of Simon & Schuster, we just didn't know what they were going to have problems with, what they were going to want to censor, with the trends being YA but really meaning middle grade right now. We make things that are just slightly older than most of those people want, and we didn't know how pushed around we were going to be when we started doing it. And so to have Julia immediately get what we were trying to say, and she did almost no censoring of anything. Yeah. I mean, really none of the censoring came from her. If there was anything, it came from above. It was so nice to be like, the person who is shepherding this project understands what it is, because you just never know when you go into those situations what it's going to be like.
Yeah, it's interesting, because we struggled for a minute or two of whether to pick this for the kids club or for the adult club.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's just that much too old for the kids.
We know.
Yeah, that was kind of, you know, I think that was one of the sticking points with other publishers is they weren't quite sure where it would fit. But Simon Schuster took our story about selling bootleg sexy anime to dudes in a Christian boarding school, and we're like, I think we can, you know, really do something with it.
Yeah.
And so far it seems like it's going well. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, because there's so much money at these companies, there's a lot of focus on, you know, the systems that they've set up and where it's going to be shelved at Barnes & Noble, and things that as an artist feel absolutely arbitrary. Like, that does not matter to me where on the shelves it is, but it does for their sales numbers. And if it has a scene with a bunch of boys jerking off in it, you might not get in the kids section, you know? And so there's a lot of factors that are kind of counter to creative freedom and telling stories that are interesting, because at the end of the day, it's a business.
Sure.
Right? And that's unfortunate, but also, how else are you going to get paid?
Yeah.
One of the things I've really thought about YA in terms of comics, I think we talked about this the other night, was that as soon as you put it on the page, it becomes for reals. Right? It's not, you can describe that blowjob in a piece of prose, and it's not necessarily sexual necessarily.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Whereas once you
I kept being like, they did this stuff in Twilight. It was fine.
Right. Exactly.
But also the thing that's crazy to me is that that makes sense for me with prose.
Yeah.
But look at the teenage, quote unquote, shows that are on TV now. Look at something like Riverdale or Sex Education. Those are shows made for teenagers.
Right.
But they are so much more explicit than anything in our book.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so frustrating to me that there's something about library systems and parents giving books to kids that everything just gets kind of softened in those spaces. And I think that gives a lot of kids want to read up. You know, we undercut what we think that they can handle, and they can handle a lot. But it is, unfortunately, you're not selling to those kids, you're selling to their parents. So,
I think perhaps with your Netflix shows, I mean, if you're a parent, you can restrict, you know, and just go, my kids will not be able to watch anything that's rated in this fashion, you know, has this word, can't see it, you know, language, we don't like language.
Right. Yeah.
It's always my favorite warning language.
Yeah.
Everything has language. But it's, you know, again, it's different in books because you've got the stakeholders. If I sell a parent the wrong book, that I'm going to hear from that parent.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
If the library does it, it's 10,000. I mean, think about, you know, all the stuff that's been going on, say, with genderqueer.
Yes.
You know, Maya's book, which is a fantastic book, which absolutely should be in schools, you know, and libraries. And there's a library system, and I want to say, is it maybe in Georgia, that voted to not fund their library. Because
I think it might have been like Idaho, maybe.
Wherever it was,
yeah.
I mean, it was insane. And then that community found out that meant that they couldn't go to the library to get Wi-Fi because we've just defunded the library. Well, but wait, we don't have Wi-Fi then? No, we don't want that.
Libraries are not just books.
Yes, they are not
so
just books.
So much more.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, that went down a path.
Sorry.
Get back onto the thing. Hey, you know, also, we'll be taking questions in a little while if anybody has any questions. So there's a mic right there in the center of the room. And so just ponder if you have anything you'd like to ask. So this started with a game of catch, just like...
I think so. Did it? I don't remember.
This book is slightly different just because we have been working on it for a very long time. We got our agent in, I want to say, 2016, 2017, and the first thing we did with him was we needed to make a pitch for a particular publisher, and this is what we came up with, or a version of this, and then that just didn't sell, didn't go anywhere, and we got caught up in some other projects, other books we were making. I made that book for DC, Shadow the Batgirl, and it just kind of got backburnered for a while. And then when we were looking for new ideas for pitches, I think we had just finished Everyone is Tulip, or we're planning our next book in the middle of drawing Everyone is Tulip. We came back to this because we felt like it was a story we still wanted to tell and was something that could fit roughly into what the book market wants to make right now. And so we went from, you know, this old pitch that we had, I think, you know, a rough idea, 5 pages of art, but we still needed to make it work in a new sense, update it, make sure it was the story that we wanted to tell. And that's when we started playing catch and talking about the characters. You know, the catch thing, we definitely do that, but it's also just, like Dave said, as we're going about our lives, hanging out, doing whatever, someone will just... in the middle of some other conversation, be like, what if Brooke did this? Or, you know, I think they should go over here, or maybe it's jackets that they're trying to get, you know?
Yeah. Basically, I came to Nicole with a high concept of, what if we made a book that was kind of like our previous book, Fuck Off Squad, but we set it in a conservative Christian boarding school, and they sold hentai. And Nicole was like, ooh, that sounds fun. Could be a little risque. Could be a little, you know, playing the upper limits of the new adult, you know, young adult thing. And then we pitched it to our agent, and he was like, that sounds great. But hentai is going to be a problem.
Right.
And we were like, what do you mean? And they were like, you can't put the H word anywhere in the pitch.
Yeah.
Because it'll just trigger librarians. We can't have anybody really. So can it just be anime? Can it be like kind of sexy anime? And we were like, fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, even if you're not intending to show any hentai, the H word is a big no-no because it, again, triggers parents. And, you know, I understand that. I get it.
Yeah, and so then we kind of like...
Shifted,
built the pitch out, remade it with that in mind. And now the book is what it is. You know, it's a coming-of-age story about four friends who are trying to navigate the gap between being a kid and being an adult and sorting out complex feelings about sexuality and emotions and what it means to start transitioning into being an adult and have responsibilities, both emotional and literal, and also just wanting to buy jackets so you can look cool at school, you know? One of the things that Nicole and I were really cognizant of when we started the book was like, everything we'd done up until this point was on a specific scale, you know, whether it be self-publishing or through Dark Horse or whatever. Well, I don't want to speak for Nicole. She drew Shadow of the Bagel. That book got some light.
Sure.
But most of the stuff that we've done has been on a specific scale. It's been aimed at a market where I hope that it gets X number of thousand views. Mm-hmm. There's no real way to know if that'll fly or flop. Mm-hmm. This book, because of the publisher involved, will change someone's life. And we went into it really trying to swing for the fences, both on a craft level and on a, if I was a person of a certain age and I found this book, what would it need to have to unlock my brain to hopefully be a, not even a better person, but just try to understand the world a little bit, just a fraction of a percent more.
I mean, I think the scale is a factor, but really that's something we try to do with every book we make.
Of course it is.
I'm always making books for high school me.
Really. Yes, absolutely. But there's just, I guess what I'm saying is there was a little bit more pressure. Normally that's a blood pact we have between the two of us. But this one was like, oh no, this will be published with a capital P. It'll be in, you know, Barnes & Noble and Target or whatever, as opposed to, you know, a select few comic book stores that are more indie centric or whatever.
Yeah, getting wide circulation for Fuck Off Squad is a little hard.
It's a little hard.
Yeah.
No, it actually has international distribution, I'm just very proud of that.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Yes. Yeah. It does make things a little bit more complicated when you put an F-bomb in the title. But
so how was the first draft, the first pitch? How was it different from this?
The first version, I think, was just a little bit more kind of aggressive in certain parts. Like, you know, we had a recurring visual gag of like they would be watching a certain type of media, and the media would be censored by having Princess from Battle of the Planet or Gatchaman's face like pop up over specific anatomical regions, and she'd be crying and saying things to the audience. Needless to say, that didn't stick around.
Right.
There still is the drawing of Princess crying, but I think she just says something like, well, Kelly, you don't like old school 70s anime or something like that, where before she was saying very different things. Some of the characters kind of got shifted around and moved, but in terms of the overarching, like, it's about religious trauma and sorting out how you can kind of try and move away from certain dogmatic approaches to life and also... defining an inner compass for what you think is right and wrong. Mm-hmm. That stuff was still there.
I mean, I think, you know, the aggressiveness aside, the main thing that changes with our drafts of books as we go through it is really they tend to start out a little flat, just in terms of we don't know who these people are yet. We don't know who these characters are yet. We don't know their goals. And we do our best and we try and think of what would motivate them. But as we're making the books, we really start to understand what makes them tick. And then you get to go back and put in all their little quirks and all of their, you know,
yeah, you're almost
small
kind of like,
moments that tap into who they are.
Yeah, at least for me, I kind of find that writing, you're almost in dialogue with the past version of yourself who didn't know what the fuck they were doing. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of like, oh, this third act climax actually isn't in theme with the story at all. It needs to be X or Y. I'll change that here. And actually, when they get introduced, to make that theme pay off better, I can change the intro so it fixes that. And that's kind of what those live reads that we end up doing really have a lot of, where sometimes it's Nicole being like, this character needs to die. Or sometimes it's me being like, I know you really want this scene of, you know, horses riding bicycles from an exploding cathedral, but I really feel like we should probably just take this out of here. And she goes, oh, yeah, I guess we'll take it out because it's definitely going to be really easy to draw that.
I mean, all the way through to as I'm drawing the book, I find, you know, deciding what posters they have on the wall or what shirts they're wearing, like those types of things come at every point in the process down to the very, very end. You know, I'm doing a pass of the book that we're working on now. And, you know, I leave a lot of that stuff blank in the sketches because honestly, it takes a long time to do. And so even in inking stages of books, I'll be like, oh, but this person really likes this band. And like, there's things to just fill them out in a way that makes them feel more like real people. And it happens at every stage of the process.
Yeah. And it's not that common that you're able to get sort of that 5 years in the drawer experience, you know?
Yeah. Had a lot of time to think about it.
Yeah. Which is a blessing and also sometimes a curse. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like some of the books that we've made that we've just kind of like started and then made through, there's kind of like an elemental power chordness to them. And some of the books where we've had a little bit more time, she doesn't do this. I do this. I constantly am putting idea on idea on idea on idea.
Sure.
I do less of that for sure. What I do is I lose momentum on an idea. And if something just happened for sure with Forest Hills where we had thought of it, you know, 3 years ago, and then had to get excited about this idea again when we kind of had moved on and were doing other things and thinking of new ideas constantly. And it's not that the idea was bad. It's just that you have to remember why you were excited about it.
Sure.
And I think we kind of switch back and forth on these things where I'll lose interest and he'll be like, no, it's going to be great. Like, we're going to do this and this and this. Or sometimes he loses interest in an idea, and I'm like, don't you remember why we love this? Like, think about who these characters are. And that happens if it's sitting in a drawer for 3 years. It happens sometimes after you've made a book, and you're like, wow, this is not what I thought it was going to be, or I thought this was great while I was making it, and now I don't know what it is anymore. And then you know, wait 6 months, read it again, and then you're like, oh, no, this is good. We did okay.
I feel like I go, like, alternating. I'll read something that we've made and be like, man, we are horrible. Or I'll read something the next, you know, 2 weeks later and be like, oh, this is pretty good. Yeah. I'd like this if I read this.
Yeah. I think this is one of the hardest parts about current comic making is that the expectation for a young cartoonist is this. Mm-hmm. It's this number of pages. It's not it's not 22 pages anymore, you know?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, without that deadline on you, without that whip on your back to make you make the work, it's really easy to start a project and then go, this is not working when you're 50, 60, 70 pages in.
Totally.
Which is, you know.
I hit a 80-page wall every time. 80 pages, that's the number.
Yeah.
I mean, with this book specifically, I think since there's four kind of central characters, we each kind of have our own little favorites. And, like, that was the thing that I think that kept refreshing the process of making it. Mm-hmm, because one of us, I would put a new scene in for Maggie, and Nicole would be like, oh, the scene where Maggie's praying and she passive-aggressively says, please forgive my friends who are gay. Like, you know, like, that is really good character meat. Mm-hmm. Or there's, you know, maybe a scene later on in the book that Nicole would suggest where maybe Kelly is doing, you know, she's like drawing in the corner where no one can see her and it's just like a silent page where she's just drawing for six panels or whatever. And I'm like, oh yeah, that'll be really good. Yeah. Like those, you almost kind of have to continually fall in love with your own characters. Or maybe not fall in love, but you have to, sometimes I think of it kind of like I'm a lawyer, like I'm the advocate for X character or Y character, because I don't think we make books about people that are endemically heroic or good people.
Sure.
I think we're both fascinated by people who are really kind of maybe left of center, maybe sorting things out, maybe in a little bit of a dark place or make the wrong choices.
Human,
yeah, absolutely. And so because of that, I think when you're reading a draft and it's like, man, is this character, like, likable? Like, will anybody other than me think this person is cool? And then the other one of us is like, oh, I really love this part where she makes the wrong choice. You're like, oh, okay. It does kind of work. You know, it'll get us through, you know.
Dave and I both make work on our own, but I don't envy cartoonists who are solo all the time, you know, because whenever I'm feeling bad about my work or just kind of feeling lost in it or bored because it's 220 pages, I can just send him pages and he goes, man, these pages are so cool. Like, look at this thing you did. And it makes me feel good. And it makes me, you know, have some feedback. Or, you know, he'll talk about something in the script. He'll be going through my pages and be, oh, you know, this doesn't really work here. Maybe we should change this. Maybe we should make it different. Or, you know, this is my least favorite thing. Maybe we should go back and add a scene. But it makes the work better and it makes it more exciting because it's not a static thing. And it allows you to have feedback all throughout the process and kind of like a buoy as you're making it, as opposed to just being in a hole drawing by yourself for 2 years, which I think happens to a lot of cartoonists.
Yeah. So when you're going to repitch this book now, you've got to rebuild it. So what's the second pitch look like? Is it...
The second pitch, I think, was a little bit more focused on like the socio-political climate of a small town, you know? Okay. It's like, we're going to do a book about these four friends where they're selling anime and they're kind of growing up, and that's the kind of like YA pitch, the hook. But it's really about what it was like to live in a small town in America in 2005. And, you know, we've jokingly said that like the fifth girl is America. You know, it's this weird kind of passive-aggressive, everybody's scared, 9/11 has just happened.
Right.
There's a very palpable xenophobia in the country, but also we hadn't quite lost our vision of Land of the Free, Home of the Brave.
Right.
So there's a very specific milieu to what's happening. Mm-hmm. And as somebody who experienced all of that, it was a strange kind of reformulating of things, because part of me was like, will this be viewed as commercial? Like, I don't know. I have no idea. I know this is what it felt like to live in a small town in 2005.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that... I think it communicates to readers. I don't know that it always communicates, sometimes when you're pitching things, to editors or publishers or people in positions of power, because they have to think about the three-dimensional chess of, like, the grand scale of publishing, where, going back to your... distribution for a book called Fuck Off Squad might be complicated. I think it probably is. However, I can tell you for a fact that we've handed hundreds of copies of that book to people, and everybody goes, Fuck Off Squad, here's my money.
Of course,
you know?
Yeah,
and it's that weird, like, what works on a one-to-one basis, maybe not on an industry basis.
Yep.
And so I think that's kind of how the pitch shifted a little bit.
And also, you know, it's very difficult to pitch because you have to sum up in a paragraph and maybe a couple character sketches what the tone and the mood and the characters and your own voice is going to be. And, you know, for something like Forest Hills that has all these mechanics, you know, it has caption boxes, it has essay pages, it has, you know, a particular feel to it, on paper... most books don't read, you know, in a paragraph the way that they feel when you are reading the physical copy of the book. And to express that to an editor in a way that they're going to understand is really, really hard.
Specifically to non-comics editors.
Sure.
Yeah. Because Julia has a background in comics, but the process for getting a book picked up by Simon & Schuster is that the editor has to fall in love with your pitch, then takes it to a meeting of other editors. If they all like it, then they take it to a meeting of a bunch of people from different disciplines within the publishing company, marketing,
sales,
whatever. And if they all agree, then it gets the green light. And one of the things I said when we were going into this new reshaped version is like, I want to take what we did with Fuck Off Squad with these super caption mechanics, you know, where if anybody hasn't read any of our books, whenever somebody walks into a scene for the first time, there's all kinds of little boxes that pop up around them. And it's like, left-handed, they're wearing their favorite t-shirt, whatever, a very kind of dense world building through minutia. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I want to take that, and I think we can push it even further so that we'll have those narrative captions, but then it'll drop down almost into a narrative basin where you'll get a full page about somebody's left sock or, you know, the family history of a character. And that way, because this book is all about these people in an environment that might not be hospitable, you'll really develop a sense of empathy for them and what they're going through, and you'll understand why they're making bad choices or right choices.
Sure.
And I sent that to the editor, and they were like, I don't know what you're talking about here. And I was like, oh, right, because these aren't comics people. So I sent them a copy of Fuck Off Squad, and I was like, when I'm talking about super captions...
Right.
These guys, right. All these little balloons, right. Like this is what we're going to do, but it's going to be even stylistically blown out further. Uh-huh. Like we're going to really swing for the fences. And she was like, oh, totally. I'll be able to sell this off of the kind of proof of concept for the other book that you've made.
So in your pitch document, you didn't have sort of sample pages or anything? Then.
We did have.
We did. We had, I think, 5 sample pages, which look honestly very different from how the book looks now. But it just... I don't know that it's always enough. There are certain companies that ask for like 25 pages, which is just crazy to me to do on spec, you know. But there is a difference, I think, especially when you're doing a book that's 200 something pages. The first 10 pages of it they're not paced in the same way. You're not getting full character stuff. Like the beginning of our book is very slow moving, and if you're doing the first 5 pages of the book, you're not necessarily getting the full tone of what you're expecting for it. And you kind of have to choose really carefully which scene you're going to show them to prove your concept. And, you know, sometimes you choose the right scene, sometimes you don't, you know, you just do your best. But I think there's a lot of editors who, it's not really enough for them to understand what it is you're making, unfortunately, because it should be.
Yeah, there's a specific set of goalposts you have to weave through.
Yeah.
And most of the time, nobody tells us what those goalposts are. So we're telling a story that's what we think is the perfect version of the story. But if there was you can't open this door with somebody knocking on a door. Mm-hmm. Like, they got to be firing a gun, because market research says that firing guns in the first 5 pages means it'll sell X number of copies. Whatever that version of that is.
Right.
And, you know, when you find a good editor or a good, you know, our literary agent helps us with a lot of that stuff. But, like, you find somebody who's on your team, they'll tell you those road signs. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a lot of that dogmatic knowledge that I just don't have access to.
Well, you have, and you can't. That you have to learn it, and it changes all the time.
All the time.
It changes all the time.
All the time.
Even though it's dogma.
Right.
Dogma changes. I don't know how that's possible. That doesn't seem like those two words work together, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. You had an agent here. Was the agent pitching it to the publishers?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it wasn't that you knew you were going to be at Simon and were aiming at a particular person. I see. Okay.
No. Yeah, the way it works more or less is we come up with a pitch, we show it to our literary agent, he says, oh, this is good, that element triggers one of those dogma doors, don't fall through that trap door, okay, we'll change that. We change it, go back to him, he goes, okay, cool, give me a little while. And then he'll send it out to, you know, 10, 15, 20, 25 places that are graphic novel industry places, and then we wait, and we wait.
It's very, very slow. mostly because most editors are overworked and underpaid. And so nobody has enough time to even read the thing.
Yep.
And getting your pitch actually read is the first step. But there are so many factors in pitching a book of why you might get rejected. You know, there's getting the person to read it, getting the right editor to read it, being at the right slot in the schedule, being the correct age range,
pages drawn in the correct dimensions.
There's tiny factors, and you just never know which one of those things might trigger someone to be like, nah, I'm just going to move on, because they get hundreds of pitches. And so you can just never be offended that your thing wasn't the perfect thing for the perfect person at the perfect time.
Yeah.
You know, and we never take offense, but it is a bummer when you wait 6 months for anybody to read it, and by the time they've read it, it's the slot's wrong, or it just doesn't fit anymore. And so it's a long and grueling process, most of which is waiting.
Yeah.
That's why I love self-publishing so much, though.
Sure.
Like, I kind of almost think of it like, you know, Nicole and I talk a lot about the one for you, one for them thing. You know, sometimes it's Nicole going off and doing something as the one for them, and sometimes it's us working at a larger publisher that takes a little bit of a time as the them, and yeah. then we self-publish something as the one for us, just because yeah. it's something we can do quickly, effectively, and we know how to. Like
right.
we've just been doing it for so long.
Yeah,
there was a big learning curve when we first started self-publishing.
Well, of course, yeah.
You said something about knowing how to use InDesign. I know how to use InDesign, and I learned by putting together books.
Yeah.
You know, and you did a lot of dealing with printers, which I appreciate. But it's not an easy process, but it's easier than it has ever been, because you can just send your files to a print-on-demand company and hire and get 100 books, and instead of having 2,500 boxes in
right.
your boxes or books in boxes in your apartment, you can do it on a much smaller scale and much quicker than you
yeah.
ever could before. And I don't know that we would have been able to build what we have if that hadn't been the case. If we'd been trying to do this 10 years ago, 15 years ago,
mm-hmm.
without, you know, whatever print on demand companies exist, you know, they're not always great quality, but then you have a physical book and you can do it and you can sell it and you can prove that you've made a thing
yeah.
very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I see that very much. So, okay, it's been accepted by Simon. You've got your pitch. Now you've got to do a script is the next step for you?
Okay. Yeah, basically.
I'm asking with question marks because other people yeah. have tried that, and they're like, oh, no, I went straight to thumbnails. Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, we do a full script, but it's exactly the process we've been describing.
Mm-hmm.
We play catch. We go, mm-hmm. You know, do dumb shit around town and break the story. Then I go away and I write it, bring it back. We read it to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
yeah, essentially we do lots of talking. And mm-hmm. then Dave takes about 3 months-ish, depending
mm-hmm.
on the book, to write, and we edit the script. And then I'm off to the races making a thumbnail. I do full... That depends on the book, but... Currently, I do the full set of thumbnails and then a full set of pencils and full set of inks and on and on and on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Where's your where's the most fun for you?
Somewhere between pencils and inks, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. I think the thing that is the most interesting is probably the thumbnails.
Yeah.
Because you're making all of the decisions, making
right.
sure that the storytelling works. Figuring out, you know, where the word balloons go. I have to letter as I go, or else there will not be enough space for the word balloons.
Mm-hmm.
It's a problem that I learned to solve, which works mostly because I work digitally. I would not have been able to do that if I didn't.
Right.
But while it's the most interesting part, it is the hardest for me because it takes the most brain power.
Well, you've got a blank page, too, that you're...
Yeah, starting with a blank page, being
nothing.
Like, I don't know what this should be. There's
yeah.
5 panels. I got to fit all this stuff on it.
Yeah.
How do I... Especially since Dave and I make comics with a focus on formalism. So I'm... Every page, I'm trying to think of something new and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't always happen. Or sometimes I don't have the energy to make that happen. And so if I'm really pushing myself, it's hard. It makes my head hurt. It takes a lot of thinking. The work is better when I do that.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I've came to this realization in the last book that we're doing that not every page has to be that. And
mm-hmm.
sometimes it's better to just tell the story clearly and succinctly than to find some cool new mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of them still in the books, but not every page has to be that.
Yeah.
Let me
just interrupt just to ask, when you're doing, say, work for hire, like The Shadow of the Batgirl,
mm-hmm.
or you're writing a Star Trek comic, are you worrying about that formalistic stuff?
Always.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Always, yeah. I mean, I do it maybe a little less.
Yeah.
But that's something I care about in comics, and
yeah.
I want to make interesting books, whether it's for DC or for
mm-hmm.
us, you know? I think Dave is great at thinking of those things, and I am... sometimes good at thinking of those things, and I try and push myself as much as possible
mm-hmm.
to find new and interesting ways. But a lot of that stuff comes either from, you know, just him or us having conversations about it, or me bouncing off something that he's said.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I'm working work for hire, there's less back and forth with the people that I'm working with, right? And so when I'm doing thumbnails, it's a little bit more in a void. Mm-hmm. I do, you know, send them and get approval and all of that stuff, but I just kind of do to my full extent what I can do in those places, and I think having the two of us and the back and forth really pushes that stuff in a way that is harder for me on my own. Mm-hmm. But yes, always. It's what I care about. It's what I think is interesting about comics. Every time I'm reading a book, the story could be amazing, the art could be amazing, but it's when you find those moments of someone doing something that you haven't seen before, mm-hmm. that's what really excites me when I read a book. And I, even if it's, you know, not the thing that's the story of my soul or whatever, I still want to have those moments.
Sure.
And it's interesting for me as an artist to to figure those. It's like a puzzle.
How big are your thumbs?
Currently, I do them digitally, so they're small, but I can make them as big or small as I want to on the page.
Sure.
I used to do little ones, like 3x3 or whatever they were. And I specifically did them that size because I didn't want to get too focused on detail.
Yeah.
And now
if you're doing 2x3, you're almost just doing shapes in a way.
Yeah, no character expressions, just kind of panel layouts, a rough idea of where things are. Mm-hmm. And it just has streamlined my process a little more to do it digitally now. It makes it easier for me. But, and faster. But I have always, you know, this is a holdover from art school of you want to do your thumbnails with as little detail as possible because you're thinking in big shapes. It's all about composition. It's all about idea. Don't get fixated on if the character has the perfect expression or if it matches the dialogue. That's not the point in that stage of the process. You just want to make sure that the composition reads, that you're expressing what you want to express. And you can figure that stuff out later in the pencils. That's where that should happen. And that's kind of why pencils excite me, actually, is because I love character acting. And that's where all of that happens.
Right.
Where I get to take my super rough, bad drawing and refine it into something that I think is fun and interesting and has personality and is representative of what the final product would be, but it's not so tight and finished.
Yeah.
There's a lot, I think, that gets lost in inks because there's a looseness of pencils and a freedom that is much more expressive. And, you know, we talk a lot about maybe publishing a book that's just my pencils, which I'm still self-conscious of because I'm always like, but I must put the perfect version forward. I can't possibly have someone see my mess. But I think that there is a lot of beauty in that mess. And I look at other artists like, you know, Loic Locatelli or who else was, I was looking at Jack T. Cole yesterday and they're so refined, but they're messy at the same time. And I love that. And there's this perfect sweet spot of mess and gestural nature to cleaned up. You can tell what's going on. Everybody's anatomy is roughly correct that I haven't quite figured out. But I would love to put out a book that looked like that. But yeah, that I love characters and that all happens in the pencil stage. And that's why I find that really interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. So you said that you do the whole,
currently, not always, but currently,
page 1 to page 350 or whatever it is, all the way through, go back 1 to 350 all the way through?
I think with Forest Hills, I was maybe still doing it in chunks.
Okay.
The current stuff I'm making now, because of some payment structures, I'm doing, and I actually think in the long run, it will make the books better because there's a lot of figuring out that happens. Figuring out how to draw your characters, how to, you know, compose the style for the book that, you know, if you're doing your inks later, things are more worked out. But I think for Forest Hills and definitely for Shadow of the Batgirl, I did them 5 pages at a time.
Okay.
I think I did, you know, I would take a week of thumbnails and do 25 to 50 thumbnails.
Right.
And then I would every week do 5 finished pages all the way through. Mm-hmm. Pencils, inks, and then I didn't color that book. So, but now because I think in the long term it will make it better, and because of I need to, you know, finish pencils to get paid and all of this stuff, I'm trying it the other way. And what I thought would happen with it is happening, is that I'm getting to the very end of my pencils and I'm bored and I want to, you know, start over or mm-hmm. do a different part of the process. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I just finished the book. So mm-hmm. it's fine. It's worked out. And I think it will make for a stronger book mm-hmm. because, you know, in the past, it, you know, it takes me 40 to 80 pages to figure out how to draw someone, which yeah. I'm not proud of. But
do you think that some parts of that job may be better for ink, for example, inking? Mm-hmm. I think the point that you made that you get a consistent, more consistent line all the way through if you're inking
yes.
the book from start to finish. So maybe you hybrid it. Maybe you lay out 25 pages, pencil 5, but that, not
that's
ink a, it
that's
until
another,
the very
that's
end.
That's another version that yeah. I've considered too. Yeah. I just, for this one, I
yeah, yeah.
surprisingly, usually the part that I get really bored at, mostly just because it's hard and I get frustrated, is thumbnails.
Right.
And for this particular book, I don't know whether I've just gotten better at making comics and it's not as hard anymore. I was really worried. I hadn't drawn a book in a long time. Yeah. And I started those thumbnails and was like, I don't know if I remember how to do this. And so I had thought about maybe I'll do as many thumbnails as I can, and then if I get bored, I'll go and pencil some stuff, and yeah. then I'll go back and I'll thumbnail. But the thumbnails went really well, and they went really nice. Quickly, and so I was like, I'm on a roll, I should just keep going.
Yeah.
And it really worked out. But I'm open to any version of that it feels right in that moment for that book.
Yeah.
And I want to try the different ways of doing it, because yeah. I don't know which one's going to work best for me. Yeah. And honestly, it's very dependent on where I am in my stage of things, too. It's not just like, this is always going to work. I don't think it will ever be like that.
Yeah, I'm really impressed that you're getting a finished page a day, though.
I mean, when DC says 5 pages a week or you don't get paid, then you finish 5 pages a week.
Sure. No, but then you've been able to apply that to places where yes. it's not, you know.
Yes. I work for Pats on the Head, and I don't like being late. It makes me very uncomfortable to not meet a deadline, which is why I both love and hate deadlines. I yeah. need them, and it makes me so much more productive and, I think, a better creator. Like, without it, I just flounder.
Yeah.
Because it's too much freedom for me.
Yeah. And when you say finished pages 5 a week, are you including the tones, the
no,
lettering?
I wouldn't. I okay. Well, now I do include lettering because I okay. do that second. I do thumbnails, and then I do panel borders and, you know, lettering. Well, I do that as I'm doing uh-huh. my pencils.
Okay.
I do them in the same stage. I letter and pencil page at the same time mm-hmm. because, for me, lettering is part of the planning process mm-hmm. because every bubble is part of your composition. The idea that...
And somebody puts a lot of bubbles in those pages.
Somebody does put a lot of words and bubbles in those
there
pages.
There are a lot of words in this book.
There are a so lot of words.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, this is not to say anything negative about letters. I think they're amazing and important. But the idea of making artwork and then putting letters on top of it doesn't really make sense to me because the letters are as much a part of the page and part of the composition and part of the story as anything else on that page. And I think a lot of cartoonists and a lot of people who read comics don't think of it that way.
Sure.
They think of it as the art's one thing and the letters are a different thing and they can happen in totally different stages. And if you get a great letter, yeah, they can. Or if you get an artist who's planning for that, mm-hmm. has an idea, leaves space, mm-hmm. it can be beautiful and absolutely work. But for I know where my weaknesses are, and one of them is not leaving enough space for letters.
Yeah. I'm assuming that you have a font that you've made of your handwriting?
Yes. Yeah.
So you're not hand lettering?
No. Yeah. No, I can't. It hurts. There's something about lettering that hurts my wrist more than drawing. I think there's like a tightness to it, maybe because it's so small. It's really painful for me to hand letter, and it doesn't look good, so I might as well not do it. This one is a font that I made, and then I have another font, like an inky font that I've made for a different style of book.
Mm-hmm. I letter using her font.
Yeah, well, because he does pencil books now, too, and so it works.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried using mine and it doesn't look as good. So I was just like, oh, I'll just use your handwriting. It'll be fine. Yeah. Moving on.
I did sign art for a long time, so mm-hmm. My lettering's not horrible.
Oh, yeah, you went to, you have a PhD from University of Trader Joe's, right?
Yes.
Did you have to sort of pre-think through your point size on your font? Just because of the nature of how many words there are on many of these pages. I'm sorry.
The biggest hurdle, actually, is that when you make your own font, the point size doesn't seem to correlate that well to what it is with other fonts. And so, yeah, you know, if you have a 0.8 font or 8-point font on your thing and then you print it out, there are times when it's much smaller than you expect, and you've planned your page and you made enough space and you think that that's fine, but it is very helpful to try and print out a page and make sure that, you know, print it to size mm-hmm. and make sure it's not tiny. I know mm-hmm. other people have had this problem. They print books and they get their final copies and it's illegible because it's so small, you know, and you think it's going to be okay, but there's some weird, especially I use some cheapy font generator, not a nice one.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't pay a lot of money for it. And so there are some like weird glitches. Like, you know, I work on my iPad, I letter in Procreate, and there's something about, I don't know whether it's just my cheapy font maker or whether it's all fonts because I haven't played around with it that much. But when I take my Procreate files and then I drop them into Photoshop, it changes all of the letting and sizes. And so I can't open my files in Photoshop, or else I'll have to re-letter, resize the whole page.
Wow.
Which I'm finding some workarounds now, which is essentially just using Illustrator instead. But there's some weird stuff with it. I've learned on the job for every stage of the comics making process, you know, laying out books, figuring out how to use Procreate, lettering in Procreate, figuring out, you know, CMYK versus RGB, and just, you know, because you can't work in RGB on an iPad because something about tablets don't have the capacity to do that. And there's weird stuff where, you know, I've had to, every cover I've ever done, I've had to draw it on my iPad and then put it in Photoshop and then change it to CMYK and then fix all the colors that got messed up. And, you know, because you want to make sure that when that thing gets printed, it looks good.
Right.
And there is so, I could go and watch some tutorials and,
Why would you watch tutorials?
I don't learn well that way, so I just
struggle
and do it the hard way and figure it out all myself. Yeah. So there's been a lot of trial and error.
Yeah. Did you? I mean, obviously, you knew what size the book was going to be.
Yes.
But did you have to make any adjustment in terms of your drawing or your lettering? Because it's smaller than a standard comic format, and yet Dave wrote as many words.
I've done other books that size before. Yeah. So Shadow of the Batgirl is the same size.
Yeah.
And I have a problem where when people send me assignments or hire me to draw a book, I get excited, and I don't like waiting for them to send me the template. So I will often just go ahead and start drawing it at a template that I've made or a size that I think it is, and invariably it is the wrong size, and I have to, once I've gotten their template, go back and fix it. And I am learning not to do that and to wait, but particularly for Shadow of the Batgirl, I think I had to redraw or resize at least 40 pages.
Wow.
That did not happen with this one because it's the same size as Shadow of the Batgirl, so I already had a template that I knew would work.
Right. And doing the tones, did you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
How long does that process take? Is that
surprisingly fast?
Yeah.
I am not a fast colorist, but doing a duotone book like this, where you're really just dropping in shadows or patterns, or making, you know, big decisions of, you know, some of it's skin tone, some of it's. That's the main reason there's two tones, actually, to this book instead of just doing like a single spot tone, is I really wanted to make sure there were some skin tones in there and you could tell the difference between that. But it does not take me long. Honestly, it's maybe a couple hours to do a page. And compared to what it takes for me to do a full color book, I don't do full color books, you know, myself. Yeah. Our last book, Everyone is Tulip, is full color, and it is beautiful because we had a colorist do it. And, you know, I went in and made sure it looked the way that we wanted to and adjusted some things. And I I think I did the first 5 sample pages of that full color myself, mm-hmm. but it just takes me so long, and the decision making that goes into that. Mm-hmm. There's so much decision making that I'm, you know, after having thumbnailed and penciled and inked an entire book, I don't want to do that.
Sure.
It takes too long.
Sure.
But I love a full color book.
You guys pitched it as a duotone originally?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I also just really like the way they look.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's very atmospheric. It makes sense for a period piece. It kind of feels, mm-hmm. this is our version of sepia tone.
Mm-hmm.
Green pia tone.
It lends it an atmosphere and a mood to it in a way that you absolutely can do in full color, but it's just kind of a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
It feels more, you know, a art school kid, you know, as opposed to full local colors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand. We don't have that much longer left. I think we've got about 15 minutes. Does anybody have any questions? Please come on up and hit the microphone over there. I'll vamp for a minute while we're doing that.
We believe in you. We believe in you. You can do it. You can do it.
Yeah. Almost there? Oh. Nope, back the other way.
Oh boy, the pressure.
The pressure, I know.
And you know how we feel.
Let's see.
Oh my gosh, you wrote a question?
I have like notes, outlines.
Oh, wow, this is way more professional than we've been up here.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think how to actually say it because I've got like bullet points.
Oh, okay.
Let's see. So I'm 19. I'm writing my own queer books. You know, I'm in the process of doing that. There are a couple. What are some advice you have for starting artists, authors? I do art too, but I haven't really found the way to put them together. But my main thing right now is a novel.
A novel?
So the question is, how do you get started writing a novel?
I'm already writing the novel. It's like, how do you get into the kind of publishing?
Oh, the industry side of it. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. Thanks.
Writing a graphic novel or a prose novel?
Currently, it's a prose novel.
Okay.
And I want to do more graphic novels in the future.
Gotcha. I think it's a little bit different for prose, and it is a little different currently. Though we're going back to normal times a little bit here. For us, which is not the standard for everybody, it's not the only way to do it, but going to conventions, honestly, having a table, being there, going to the bar or social things afterwards, making friends, making peers, interacting with other people in the world that you want to exist in, you know, whether that's, you know, publishing prose shows, whether it's comics shows, really making friends at the same level that you are, that you can bounce ideas off of. And, you know, I've had so many people pass me jobs that they didn't want to do, you know. And there's the kind of selfish version of it that's, you know, like you might get a job from someone. And then there's the non-selfish version is that you're building a community and you have people that you can, you know, ask if this contract is okay. And then they can ask you, I'm working with this editor and they said this weird thing. And how do you feel about that? You know, building the community, I think, is the first step.
We run this is a little bit outdated at this point, yeah. But it was very helpful to us a number of years ago when we were really doing the circuit. We run a Facebook group called Let's Do All the Conventions, which is just a creator feedback group for people who want to table at conventions, need to know when the application deadlines are, need to know, oh, is this show more of a X show or a Y show? This show has a big anime fan contingent. That show doesn't buy indie comics. They're just there for cosplay, whatever, you know, that kind of thing. So if you want to hang out on Facebook, which no one does, but, you know, it's valuable sometimes to just have a group of people that are all sort of doing the same thing.
I mean, I think currently Discord is kind of the place.
Yeah.
As Twitter dies. I just joined Hive.
We'll see. You think you're going to make a Discord group?
I don't use Discord because it overwhelms me with people sending me messages all the time. But I know many cartoonists and writers who do. I think there's one that's just like a cartoonist
group.
There is
a cartoonist. There's a few cartoonists.
I don't know what they're called, though.
Well, frankly, I don't run them, but they're much more clicky. For the Let's Do All the Conventions thing, I just approve anybody who wants to come in there. And then once, if somebody's in there like promoting, hey, come to my convention or whatever, I'm like, guys, that's not what this is.
Yeah.
And I, you know, politely kind of shuffle them off. But yeah, there's also a show, or there's a website called Convention Scene. Not scene like C, but C like S-C-E-N-E. And I can spell. And that show, you can look up in your whatever geographic part of the country you're in, and it'll show you, oh, I'm interested in horror conventions, or I'm interested in queer literary conventions, or whatever. And there's lots of, mm-hmm. it's just a Rolodex or an index of these are all the conventions. Mm-hmm. Do you I guess the other thing is, do you have a website that you could point people to, which
That's
has a portfolio
important.
Of your work?
I don't have a website, but I have my Instagram.
I know this is, websites are kind of outdated, except for this specific thing, which is when you apply to table at a convention, the way that they kind of evaluate people is they just look at websites. So they go, oh, you have a portfolio and you look okay, you get a table. You do not get a table. Like, I know of people who were working professionals who just didn't have a very good website, and they didn't get into conventions to table because the website is such a big portfolio piece for this one minute area of the industry.
Also, just making sure that you are very accessible on your social, having your real name if you're comfortable, you know, whatever pseudonym you're going to use, or your real name, having a real accessible email and a portfolio website. Because I've had so many people, when I was hiring for colorists, there were so many people that I looked at and I was like, you're cool, I would hire you. And then their avatar was not their face, their handle was ilikeanime.com, you know, or whatever. And I didn't know what their name was. I didn't know how to contact them. They had their direct messages closed. So I couldn't hire that person because they weren't accessible. And making sure that people can very quickly see who you are and see how to contact you, very important.
Yeah. Also, self-publishing. Like, I know we've said it like 100 times, but like, it really, it allows you to hand an editor or a literary agent or whoever just a thing, a physical object that can't be ignored. PDFs can be ignored. Emails can be ignored. But when you go to somebody and say, look, I took the time and effort, and I have the respect for my work to put my money down on the line, and I think this is good, you should pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's equally as true for prose? Because my understanding was in the prose field, self-publishing is looked upon.
It is looked down upon, but
not real.
But here's
that is changing, though.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. There's a difference between doing a micro run and like going and seeking out editors or agents or whatever, and like running a self-publishing empire of Bigfoot romance novels or whatever your thing is.
The main difference between pitching for comic stuff and pitching for prose is that, unfortunately, for prose, you have to hand them a finished manuscript.
Yes.
Where pitching for comics, you give them a, you know, paragraph and some art, which, thank God. and it's a little baffling to me because the logic there is comics take so long to make, which they do. So we don't want you to have to spend 2 years drawing this book for nobody to pick it up. But also, prose novels take a very long time to write and to edit. And by the time you're done and you've done all your self-editing and you're 300 pages of prose, then you hand it to an editor and they make you edit it some more. You know? Mm-hmm. So the logic there doesn't really make sense to me, but I'm not a prose person. But I think the other thing, that advice that Dave and I always give, which is more of a comics thing than a prose thing, is start small. Write some short stories. Do little bits that you can just hand to someone, same way. It will be less expensive to do a micro run of a short story than it would be for a full length.
Or
novel.
Specifically for the prose world, like, there's lots of competitions for short stories. There's lots of, like, I think Washington Post does, like, every X number of months, they do, like, a, check it out, you can send us stuff, and we'll publish it on the WAPO website, and it's, you know,
just be wary of anything that's charging you to submit to those.
Oh, yeah.
Don't do that.
yeah, that's not cool. Yeah, I hope any of that was helpful.
I have maybe one and a half, two more questions.
Go for it, please.
Let's do one, but yes.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. This is a little bit unrelated to the other question. So as you're working as a team, do you have anything in place in case something happens and you stop working as a team? I had some drama.
We should.
We should.
We keep being like, oh, we need to make a contract, get our agent to pull up a contract. We've been working together for 7-8 years, something like that. And it was so informal at the beginning, and there was no publishing contracts. It was just us making it, so we never did it. And the answer is absolutely we should. If you are able to, definitely do that.
Yeah.
It's a fail-safe. Nobody should be offended by you saying we should do this because they are protecting themselves as well. So, yes.
I made that 7-8 year mistake.
Yeah, like we're okay so far.
Yeah, I have them with other collaborators. And they're very simple. It's just like, this is who owns what. This is what you're getting paid. This is what I'm getting paid. This is how the project shapes out. If you don't show up, X, Y, and Z happens. Mm-hmm.
And then what about ownership? Like, if you're both collaborating,
that should be in there,
in ideas.
Yes. Yeah, basically, you can shape it however you want, but the versions that I have with other people are, if you don't show up after X number of whatevers, then I'm not going to wait for you, because the idea, like, those relationships usually are a little different than Nicole and I, where we're making a thing together. That's usually me as a writer and an illustrator who's coming on board, and they're equally, they own... Once it's finished, they own it with me. I think anybody who, especially in comics, and there's a long history of this, doesn't split ownership with the illustrator, maybe their heart's not right in the right place just a little bit. I don't think it's cool.
Everything we make is 50-50.
Yeah. But prior to that, as a fail-safe, I have kill clauses in my contracts with other artists where it's like, hey, if you don't show up, then I am free to... take this idea and go do X, Y, and Z with it with a different artist. And it'll be a different book because it wouldn't be you, but you won't have any claim to it. But I feel like it's a little different for Nicole and I because we really sculpt things together.
When you're doing these kind of arrangements with other creators, does that include the media rights as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because some of the stuff we do is just self-publishing and some of the stuff is... with major publishers, major publishers in comics. And I split media rights right down the middle. It's 50% the artist, 50% me.
Whether it's self-publishing or not, because you just never know who is, who would have thought that Teenage Ninja Turtles, a story about turtles who eat pizza and fight ninjas.
And are a Daredevil parody.
Exactly. Right. Well, that's the...
Yeah. would be what it is today.
Yeah.
They never thought that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And so any tiny little thing that you make, think about, it may or may not happen, but those rights could mean something someday. And you don't want to give that up because that's yours. You made it.
There's also a version of that, too, that I think there's a conception maybe that writers created an idea. And I don't fully buy into that. I kind of feel like, when there's a finished comic, that's a finished created idea. And I don't think that you get Spider-Man without Steve Ditko. I think he's at the very least 50, if not 60, 70, 80, maybe even 90% of Spider-Man.
Like, it depends on the writer, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I know, but I'm saying for Spider-Man.
Right, yeah. To me, this is a little bit of a tangent from what you've asked, but I feel like to me, when specifically in comics, artists need to co-own that stuff. Like, it's just not... To me, it's kind of immoral when they're not given that position.
Well, also, the thing wouldn't exist if the artist didn't draw it.
Sure.
So your idea is just an idea until it's on a page.
Yeah. Do you feel any... I'm sure the answer is going to be no, but do you feel any struggle when you're working on a Batgirl or working on a Star Trek of, I'm going to create a new character... but you don't actually get any rights for it whatsoever.
I mean, that's kind of a situation, that's a very long conversation, but it's a situation that I feel like kind of has to be evaluated case by case. Like, I created co-created with Angel Hernandez an entire alien race for the Star Trek miniseries we did.
Right.
Will that alien race show up again? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Will it be in one of the TV shows? Probably not, because we know how... canon works in the Star Trek universe. It's a top-down thing.
Sure.
I think it's a different situation for Marvel and DC.
I think it's always a factor. I think You know, when you are making a book for a big company, Marvel and DC, where you know you're not going to have any ownership of those characters, you just have to think about how much you're willing to put into having that opportunity, getting to draw Batman. What are you getting out of that situation that makes it worth possibly losing the rights to a character? And if it's worth it to you, then do it. And if it's not, then don't make a character for them, because you're not going to have ownership over that.
Yeah.
Rob Liefeld always says, you don't get Frank Miller without Elektra, and you don't get Elektra without Frank Miller.
That is agreed with 100%.
Yeah, if it's a situation where you think that either you just really want to do that job, or it's a thing that's going to help your career, then in the long run, that's worth it.
Yeah.
But if it's not helping you, then don't do it.
I feel like working in a creative industry, the real kind of struggle isn't a craft struggle, it's a compromise struggle. And the compromise always shifts. Sometimes it's this compromise.
Sure.
Sometimes it's, am I willing to give rights to X collaborator that I'm not on good terms with? Not that I've had that, but people do have that.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's, am I willing to do a book with a publisher that I don't believe in their greater mission statement, but they're the ones who are willing to put out my work?
Right.
You know, so compromise, in my opinion, is the true form of every artist.
Well, especially with professional commercial publishing.
100%.
That becomes a completely different thing than making something for yourself.
100%. You
know? I have a very cynical adage that I say, which is there are no true wins in comics. There's no pure wins. There's always some form of compromise, no matter what. And that is getting less true for us.
Yeah.
And maybe I've been wrong all this time. But up until this point, you know, there's always going to be, you know, an issue of money or an issue of rights, or the deadlines are weird, or you don't like the people you're working with, or there's just always something that takes this win and makes it less than you want it to be. Mm-hmm. And what I've been trying to learn is how to see the parts of it that are win, you know, and appreciate what you're doing, what you're making, that you're getting to make comics. And really internalize that and remember that we're very fortunate to get to tell stories.
Yeah.
Because it's hard when nothing's ever perfect.
So I hope that answered your questions. We have almost no time. They put up the closing credits on the screen.
All right. Okay.
So let's wrap it up. I have the last two questions. Is there anything you guys want to plug that's coming up in the future that someone who might have loved this book would also enjoy or not?
I would say, well, first of all, please buy Forest Hills Bootleg Society, available from bookstores, wherever, or at the convention.
You can also buy it from Comics Experience, and we have signed copies that we will get at no extra cost. So go to the website, comicsexperience.com. You'll find it.
We're going to hang out for a little bit at the booth and sign after this if you'd like to get a... I'll probably do a sketch for you if you come by.
I was talking to the people who are on video.
Yes, of course.
Yes. Sorry, you guys don't get a sketch.
I forgot about that.
Because those guys will be around for a while.
Yes.
So, you know.
Yes. Please buy it at Comics Experience.
Well, yes. Is there something else you'd like to plug?
I am currently self-publishing a book. Three issues out or so far, and the fourth issue should be out in December. It's called Halloween Boy. It's an adventure comic centering around interdimensional travel, intergenerational trauma, and spooky boys. You can find it at heydavebaker.com. That's my personal website.
I have two things coming up now, actually. I have an illustration zine called Rituals, which is coming out through Silver Sprocket in, I want to say, January, which is about the quiet moments of prepping yourself to go out into the world and be who you want to show everyone you are. And then I have a book called Pet Peeves that is coming out through Avery Hill in May, which is kind of about finding yourself lost after college and growing up and the negative cycles that we can get sucked into.
Nice. Fantastic. I look forward to all of that stuff. You have a website of your own as well?
Yeah, it's just my name, NicoleGoo.com, with an X.
There you go.
GOUX.
Yeah. And you're on the Instagrams and the social
all
medias
the things.
And all the
all
things.
Of them.
All the things.
All those same things.
This one's heydavebaker.com.
And on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter, it's at xdavebakerx. Nicole, you are?
Depends. Twitter and Hive and something else. What is the other one? It's just Nicole Gu, at Nicole Gu, and then Instagram is at NGu.
Very cool. Very cool. The last question is the same question again in every show. We have a lot of people. You actually kind of answered this one already, but you'll come up with something new. I know you will. A lot of people watch these shows who want to make comics. They don't know how to start. They don't know where to go. So I'd love sort of, you know, your comic specific. What's the piece of advice that you would give someone, you know, whether it's a physical thing, whether it's an emotional thing, a spiritual thing, a philosophical thing?
Mm-hmm. I would say the hyper-specific is universal. Telling stories that only you can tell from your perspective about either your lived experience or your viewpoint on the world that no one else can do is something that is irreplicable. Mm-hmm. And I think that that shows in the work when it's being done.
For me, it is always start small, because I've talked to so many people who have this 300-page ongoing epic that they want to do, and they've built it up so much in their head that they cannot even start. And putting something out, either online or in particular physically, and having a copy of something that you have made just does wonders for learning how to make the thing. And I think, particularly for my experience, when I started making comics, I didn't know how to make comics. I learned by doing them, and I started with 8 pages, and then some 3-panel strip mini comics. And I learned so much in the process of making those things that if I had tried to do a 200-page book, it would have been bad. You know, it still would have been cool because I'd made a thing, but it would not have been what I wanted it to be. And so starting at 8 pages and then 12 pages and then 20 pages and building up, you just learn by doing and by reading other people's stuff. Yeah. Is really, I think, the way to kind of, short of, you know, going to CCS and getting a degree in comics, which is cool, but I don't think you have to do. I think it's a really wonderful way to learn the skills that you need to make the thing.
Very much so. I think those are both great pieces of advice. Could you guys help me give a hand for these guys being
Thank you.
Here? It's really a fantastic book. And if you're sitting at home and you don't know what to read, and there's still definitely people sitting at home needing something to read, this is really smart. It's about the things that Dave said. It's about being at a time where you're transitioning from one, you know, age group to another, and learning to address that and figuring it out, and you're shaping your place in the world. And these are themes which I think are universal and everyone can love. And it's wrapped in a great story about anime bootlegs, and it's so well drawn, and it's, you know, it's so well written, and you're gonna love it. So buy this book. Next month, for the December Club, just so you know, our next interview, the book is Thieves by Lucy Bryan, she's French, and we will be talking to her next month. This is, I don't want to put it this way because you guys are sitting on stage with me, but this was the best graphic novel I've read in, like, 5 years. No, I mean, like...
Fair. I follow her online.
Like this to me is kind of on the level of a Serious Polyp, you know, the Mazzucchelli book. It's just a real masterpiece of. So I'm really looking forward to talking here. The next Kids Club for December, we're talking to Melanie Gilman about Other Ever Afters, her queer fairy tale book, which is fantastic. I have a couple of thanks I want to do super fast here. I want to thank Fan Expo for giving us the space. I want to thank, yeah.
Yay, Fan Expo, yay.
I want to thank Chuck and the crew who were running the show.
Yay,
so thank you
Chuck and the crew, yeah,
for
big
that.
Chuck.
Yeah, I want to thank Jordan, my producer. We don't have to thank. We don't
okay,
have to,
okay, all right,
we
okay.
don't have to get ridiculous with everybody because they're not in the room.
Okay.
But I want to thank Jordan, my producer, and I want to especially thank my staff, Zoe, Kat, and Katie, for running the store and basically giving me the freedom to sit here and talk to people about comics and have hour and a half conversations. Which probably didn't feel like an hour and a half.
No, it didn't. No.
Right? That felt like 20 minutes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thank everybody for that. And I want to thank all of the members of the club, some of whom are here, others who are watching this later. Thank you for being a member, for supporting the medium of comics, for supporting great creators, for supporting a store that's focus is on trying to make comics better. So let's keep working at it. We'll keep making comics better, and we will see you next time.